Greetings, nerds. This is Cena Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Polk. How are you doing tonight, Will?
Doing very well, sir. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good.
That's good.
I did my homework, and I about an hour ago, I watched the Spider-Verse short film, The Spider Within.
Yeah. What you think of it?
I'm going to be honest. And I like Miles, and so it was good to get something from into the Spider-Verse world and Miles and everything. And I understand the concept. I love that it's with Charity. I got bored about 2 minutes in. If I'm being completely honest, for some reason, I was just like, wow, this is dragging on. It felt longer than 8 minutes for me.
Huh.
So I love that it works for some people, and some people really enjoyed this. Yeah. And again, I think the message is great, and the concept and why they did this in support of mental health. At the same time, I'm just going to be honest. And for whatever reason, I wasn't like overwhelmed by what it was.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fair. I mean, I liked it. I really felt that the message was, it was truly, for lack of a better term, a PSA for mental health awareness and, seeking help for when you're feeling overwhelmed. And I thought a lot of the visuals and things that, were in it, as far as when Miles was, having the panic attack and everything. I mean, I thought it really, really did a good job of really visualizing what he was feeling and all the pressures that he was having. So for me, the short film worked very, very well. So, I mean, I wasn't expecting it to be like, part three of the trilogy or whatever, but it was just it was a short film, and really thought it was very, very well done. So.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I'm not putting it down. I think it is 8 minutes long. To me, it felt longer, but, I think it's worth checking out, especially if you have watched the two Spider-Verse movies and have been following Miles' story. Yeah. I think it's just a nice little appetizer, for in the meantime, as we continue not to get the third movie, which was supposed to come out in March, but I told Will that there's no way in hell. A long time.
Yeah, we should be talking about the third film right now instead of this short film. But we'll get that we'll get that at some point. So we did get a Spider-Verse in March. It's just not the one everybody expected.
Nope. Man. And plus, besides, we just have too much going on tonight. We're going to talk about Shogun Episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. And I believe this is taken from IMDb. Lady Ochiba returns to Osaka in order to accelerate the region's campaign against Toranaga. In Ajor, Toranaga tests Mariko's loyalty to his cause. So, Will, essentially there's two halves of this episode. One half about Mariko and one half about Ochiba. But let's start with Lady Ochiba, since she's kind of the new character who's entering the fold. What did you think about everything that was going on? And I'm going to emphasize that let's stick to also present day for the moment. Okay. But in present day Osaka, with Lady Ochiba's return, Lord Ishiba, and just the overall the regents and what's the political things that are happening there.
Yeah, so just sticking to the present day, I thought that this episode and focused, it's called Ladies of the Willow World, and it was just a true testament to, these are probably two of the most powerful women in Japan. Actually, three when you consider the courtesan, Lady Kiku. It really was that on display. I mean, it looked Ushida was definitely, she definitely returned to Osaka Castle with the power of being the one who bore the heir for the kingdom. And so I just really, looking at the present day and then all the stories that were going on, you know, within the castle, with the her influencing Ushida as far as trying to get the regents to adopt a fifth member so that they could finally impeach Torunaga, everything, all the political machinations that were going on really made for a very, you really recognize the force and that she is. And then of course, as we learn more about why she is the way that she is, she was a very compelling character. And definitely whenever when we saw from the end of last week's episode, wondering how things were going to unfold, it definitely did not disappoint.
So, yeah, I agree with you to an extent. I like this character. I think she's an important character to have. She does definitely has a motivation. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But there are two things that I have problems with. One, it's still not really made clear to me how the mother, not the queen, not the person who was actually married to the previous emperor, but the mother of the heir has all of this power suddenly, upon her return, to the point where it was mentioned several times in the episodes by the regents and the lords in Osaka that they were basically being held hostage by this woman.
Yeah.
But they never quite explained to me, or at least I couldn't tell by what I was seeing and understanding about why she holds that power over them and could do that. I mean, I understand the manipulation of Ishido, but even he felt like, even it seemed like he was being held hostage. So maybe that was a whole thing. Like, he was basically her puppet. So even though she was pushing him to move things along, he's the one who actually holds power. It wasn't clear to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's very clear. I mean, Ishido he's just truly, he's not good at the political game. I mean, he thinks he is. But he's just the pawn. And I think where she gets a lot of her power is the simple fact that the Taiko had many courtesans who were trying to sire him a male heir, and no one was able to do it. But she, as she said, she took, compelling fate. I mean, she just kind of took the thing on hand and ripped his eyes out or something. I think I'm paraphrasing, but I mean, she was the one that was able to keep the lineage going. And, of that, she has a very special, very special place in this, being that she is the mother to the heir to the Taiko. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I would just like to understand more about why culturally that would be the case at this time.
Well,
because in similar times and similar stories, that's never the case. So I just culturally, I want to understand that a little bit more. Like, I can see the importance of that position. And I will be honest, I did not like the line about, well, I stared fate in the face and scratched his eyes out. I'm like, what are we talking about here? What kind of metaphor is this? Like, what do you mean? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, whatever, I guess. I mean, it was an arranged relationship, so.
Well, yeah, it's an arranged, she was a handmaid, if we're going to go into Handmaid's Tale. Like, she was just there to have sex with him. so that she could produce an heir, because everyone else so far has failed and they needed someone. And so I get why she's upset. I understand that, like, because it basically, there were a lot of implications that they drugged her. And I want to know, okay, so how much of it was actual rape? Because I think there was some part of it that was pretty much rape.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on top of that, we get the flashbacks, which I knew right away for some reason that the girl who was playing with young Mariko in the flashback sequences was Lady Ochiba. And who is revealed at that time to also be the daughter of the ruler at that time, who we know that from previous episodes, Mariko's father kills that ruler, which leads to devastation for her own family. So Lady Ochiba she remains behind after her father is killed, and then she has to bear the child for his successor. Horrible situation. Just disgusting, just gross, and all of that. So, like I said before, that's one of the reasons why I can appreciate her character, because all of the motivation is there for her doing what she's doing.
Yeah.
Then the question is, well, and this is the one thing I can praise Lord Ishibe about. He asked the question I've been wanting to know. Why does she hate Tarnaga? Like, because people have to ask this question.
Right,
and
right.
Then she explains that she believes that he is the one who actually had the plan. He did not commit the act. She knows that. But he was the planner behind the series of events that led to her father's death. Okay. Well, we will. I'll let you go, Will, and share your thoughts about that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that also plays a role in why she does have some of, you know, in addition to what we discussed as far as, you know, siring the heir, bearing the heir to the throne, also the fact that her father was a very powerful warlord, and also, you know, I think that also lends to her, you know, having some, you know, higher station because of her lineage. So with the assassination of her father and thinking that Tornaga was behind it, you know, it definitely, you know this character is based off, and all these characters are based off, you know, real people and real events that happened in feudal Japan. Mm-hmm. And so the person that her father's based off of was truly a very nasty, evil man, and many of the other feudal leaders did want him gone, and so many of the prominent nobles wanted him gone. So it makes sense for her to figure out to have this feeling that Tornaga was definitely behind this, even though it doesn't seem that Tornaga orchestrated the plan. He may have just been a part of it and just very happy that this guy is gone, so that, you know, things can sort of materialize how they should. It reminds whenever I was watching this whole dynamic and stuff between Mariko and Ochiba, especially when they were younger, I definitely was getting some House of the Dragon vibes with Alicent and Rhaenyra. And Alicent's like role as far as, you know, marrying Viserys, because I did see some sort of similar parallels with their relationship and how their relationship ended up like falling to the wayside because of bigger issues of state.
I did not think about them at all during this episode for some reason. But I can see what you're getting at with those parallels. To go back to what you were saying about Tornaga, though, thank you for bringing that up, because that was going to be my point. I think it's interesting how in Osaka, Ochiba reveals that this is why she hates Toranaga. And all I'm thinking in my head is like, wait a second, let's rewind, go back to the Toranaga scene with Mariko. Toranaga is clueless as to why you hate him. So if they're going to say when all is said and done that no, Toranaga was behind it, then I'm just going to be like, okay, flaw, because he would have, and it's hard for me to say, oh, there's absolutely no way, just because of how the whole conversation goes with Mariko, where he does talk about her father and why she was married off the way, not the way, but when she was, but actually both to who and mm-hmm. when she was, because he needed to get her out of there before everything unraveled around them. So it was a protection clause.
Yeah.
Some could also argue with the way he was talking to her and given his closeness with her father, that he definitely knew about the plan.
Oh yeah.
But the actual orchestrator, I don't know. And maybe when Lady Ochiba says it, he's the only one she can kill at this point. You know, she's the only one for her to settle the score in her mind, he's got to go, because he knew about it and he could have prevented it.
Yeah.
So, and you know, maybe, I mean, I wrote fan fiction in episode one about this. But maybe so long ago, she's also pissed because at one point she really liked him.
It's possible.
Yeah. And so I guess to go back to that first episode, it now makes more sense about why she was sent away, because mm-hmm. he knew about her despisement when she was, because he sent her away and the heir remained in Osaka. So maybe that's why, even though they don't really explain it, in my opinion, but maybe that's why Lord Ishiba wanted her to return to Osaka, because, well, if Toranaga wants her gone, then she must be of value for somebody who's against Toranaga, like an ally. The enemy of my enemy is my friend type of deal. But you got to take in consideration, her dad was crazy. She's probably a bit crazy too. So
exactly. But also, I guess that's the thing too, that even though, you know, and I guess that was part of the reason why Toranaga and other noblemen and people wanted her father dead, was because, after that, it did lead to the Taiko's reign. I mean, there was no more war during that period. And also, you know, the thing that really was provided some clarity, and I know we were wondering, like, you know, as far as Mariko and the wedding and the timing and stuff, one other element that did get filled in this week was that, you know, Mariko's father wanted her to live so that she could get that revenge one day. So it definitely, like,
revenge on who?
Since honor demanded that her family had to, like, kill themselves because of her father's treason, she would get her revenge on the people who, like, falsely accused her father of being a treasonous person.
But he was. He killed the Lord. Like, he killed.
Yeah, but everyone knew. But he killed the Lord because of the Oshiba's father was just, he was a terrible man, and because of that, he was, you know, it was, you know, causing a lot of conflict and stuff. So
no, I understand all of that, but I just don't buy that she's gonna get revenge on the people who took, like, made her father kill themselves, because, like, She wanted, the way the culture is being explained to me, the noble thing to do would be to let her die. I mean, the person she could get revenge on would be her husband and killing Buntaro because he keeps commanding that she lives. But I don't feel like she necessarily has anyone that she needs to get revenged against. It's more like she needs.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily just this one person. I mean, there's probably a many enemies that they all had because, again, these were all feuding clans in Japan at the time. So it's not just, I don't think it's just one, like, she's just not, you know, only like fighting against Ochiba's father. I mean, it's other, probably other folks as well.
Well, Ochiba's father is dead.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are other enemies, you know, like we saw the other four regents that are present that were around. So,
but that, see, there's also a time difference here. Like, a lot of people profited from the death of her father, including Torunaga.
Yeah.
All right, and now we're talking about two different people. Okay, so a lot of people profited from the death of Mariko's father because he was like the sacrificial lamb of saying like, well, somebody has to go down for this. And for whatever reason, which fingers crossed, maybe we get some more flashbacks and more of this is explained, but it was Mariko's father who drew the shortest straw and is like, okay, so you and your family must die. Okay. So in my mind, as we discuss this further, why doesn't Mariko kill Torunaga? Because, hey, if Ochiba is right and it was all Torunaga's idea, technically then that means that he manipulated her father to do his dirty work. And and her father would be living, like, her whole life would be completely different if it wasn't for Torunaga.
Yeah, but I don't see that's just, and I guess that gets to our point.
I don't think that's ever going to happen, but I'm just saying.
No, but I think it also answers one of our questions in that, and what we've discussed is Torunaga probably wasn't the person that was the orchestrator of this plot.
Yeah, but I have yet to see.
Because he doesn't want to be shogun. I mean, he's made it clear that he doesn't, you know, he just.
Thank you for bringing this up. Yeah. This is another problem I had with this episode. And before I continue, let me just say, I actually really liked this episode. It's one of the stronger episodes, in my opinion. However, my favorite character, Torunaga, he said some stuff that isn't adding up to me. Like this whole, I don't want to be shogun. And suddenly I'm looking at him and I'm thinking to myself, then what the heck are we watching? What are you doing? You don't want this? Then why? Why is this going on?
Well, I don't get it. Because he, you know, he was loyal to the Taiko. And his goal, I think his ultimate goal, and even though Ochiba doesn't see it, Torunaga orchestrated, you know, he wants her son to be able to take the throne. And that's his motivation.
Well, see, that's wonderful, but I don't get then why no one else is supporting that.
Well, because everybody else has, I mean, you know, we know Ishido definitely, he has his sights on things and he can't strike down Ochiba and the son, because if he does, then that will openly create war. So, you know, so he's, you know, he's doing all these, like, you know, he's trying to do this impeachment so that, you know, that will remove, you know, he can say, I got cover by the Council of Regents that, you know, that Torunaga should be gone. And I think Ochiba is supportive of that because, I mean, she blames Torunaga for the death of her father.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see what more motivations or lack of motivations reveal itself. It's just, this is again why Yabo Shige is my favorite character because he's the one who I know exactly, A, his motivation. Mm-hmm. You can't trust him. Love that. Love that transparency. Yep. Can't trust you. I get it. Yep. I understand. Very confusing.
Yeah. Yabo Shige definitely, like, you know, he knows at some point he's gonna die on a battlefield somewhere, because even this episode he was like, I need to draw up a will.
Right. He was barely in this episode, but he was the only one. I love how he talks to Ami. He's like, who cares about what the barbarian is being rewarded right now? Yeah. We are about to enter a war that we can't win, and we got our lives. Like we got to figure out a way out of this. Like that survivalist mentality. I can respect that. Yeah. which Omni just is there complaining because Blackthorn takes over the cannon regimen, and then later on in the episode, he also is offered the opportunity to hook up with Omni's courtesan, Kiku, Lady Kiku. So what did you think about the Mariko of it all?
Yeah, her story this week was just equally very compelling. I mean, because, you know, she and Blackthorn had, you know, she's only treating him as her interpreter, nothing more. But, you know, everybody there at the camp knows that something's going on between them. And to see how, you know, Tornaga, you know, sees it, you know, there was her husband sees it, and hide that, I guess, what was the eightfold I mean, that we're seeing that at play here as things progress in the series. So she really, again, like I said, you know, Shiba maybe is the powerfulest woman in Japan, but Mariko is like right there, not far behind, because of where she is positioned with all these things going on.
We do have two episodes of a different show to talk about, so I don't know how much I want to argue with you. So I'll just say, if Mariko was really good with the whole practice of the Eightfold Fence, then why the heck does everybody know about she's loved and probably has had sex with Blackthorn? That's all I'm going to say.
I'm just saying that she thinks she's good at it. I mean, she's good at, she's playing that game, but everybody else sees it.
Yeah. Then I just don't understand why you would say she's so powerful, because if she's playing a game, but she's sloppy at it, she's not doing that great. Well, I don't say that she's as powerful as you're saying she is. I think she is a good ally for Tornaga, and someone who I think, because he hates his son right now, like he wishes like that was her daughter or his daughter. Yeah. So I understand all that, but I don't think she's that powerful. But then again, rewind everyone. I still question the power that's coming from Lady Ojibwe. I think Lady Ojibwe just has a lot of confidence.
and you fleshed out what I meant by power. I mean, I think that her power is in that her role with Tornaga and also I guess the interface.
She even gets scolded in this episode. Because she gets scolded and punished, because she gets sent to go and basically watch Blackthorn have sex with Lady Kiku. That was the whole thing. And then she acts very unprofessional and mistranslates the offer to go with them. And she must stay behind, which I just would like to say my favorite scene in this entire episode is actually the saying of the Lord's Prayer in both Japanese and English simultaneously.
Yeah, she was praying. Yeah, she was. It was. Yeah, I think it was actually Latin. That's why he recognized it. because she was saying it because she's Catholic. So
yeah. Oh, she was saying it in Latin.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's why he recognized
it. I did not hear that at all.
Yeah.
Well, either way, to
yeah, but it was a powerful scene.
Frame that shot.
Yeah.
And just how the execution was so good, and then to have the translation or whatever you want to call it, between Lady Kiku and Mariko at the end. Great scene. The actor who plays Blackthorn did an amazing job with his eyes in that whole sequence, because he was very captivated and all of his emotions was written on his face. So hats off to them. So despite me like questioning power of these women, this overall episode is very strong because of those two scenes and a few others as well.
Yeah.
And it's just good to see multiple characters start to get fleshed out.
Yeah.
Even though I wish some motivations would be explained a little bit more.
Yeah. I agree with you though, as far as the two most powerful scenes, because I mean, I think that whenever they were saying the Lord's Prayer, I mean, it just showed that intimacy. I mean, you know, that they, when he heard, when she was praying, and again reinforces that. And then when they were in the Willow world at the brothel, and the three of them in the room, and just even not only the eyes, but also like whenever he was going to go get pillowed, and you know, he reaches out with his hand and like they brush hands too. And that scene, that was just between the words, and everything about those two scenes were just really, really powerful this week.
Right. And I like how the first scene is actually intimacy through pain, because mm-hmm. they were saying that prayer amidst all of the losses that had occurred with the earthquake. And yeah. then at the end, it's pain through almost pleasure and seduction yeah. and all of that. So it's interesting to see both sides of intimacy and affection display. So
yeah.
we will continue next week with Shogun episode 7. That brings us to our new show that we will start covering, Three Body Problem. Lord, I am so sorry to all of the listeners who have been listening to us for a few weeks. And anytime I mention this, because I swear to God, Will never corrected me. I'm pretty sure I referred to it as Three Bodies, One Problem for
so long. I just, yeah.
It's called Three Body Problem. We watched the first two episodes. Do we understand why it's called Three Body, One Problem? Or Three Body Problem? No, not a clue. But yeah. So let us start with episode 1, Countdown. Unsettling events put a group of brilliant friends on edge as a mystery unravels with origins tracing back to China during the Cultural Revolution. Will, what did you think about this first episode?
So this first episode really, it starting out the way that it did in 1966 and the height of the Cultural Revolution in China, I was not expecting that at all.
No, God, no.
It really set the stage. This first episode overall just really sort of set the stage for the series, you know, introducing us all to the characters, the production values, the sound, everything about it. The storytelling was really, really cool. I know from what I understand, this scene actually, that where things started out, in the book written by Lee Sho, it was actually in the middle, but whenever they translated it to English, just they actually flipped the order. But it really like set the tone as far as like all the things that proceeded afterwards with, you know, with science, with religion, with we see Yi Wenji in the crowd seeing her father get executed, and how the mother, like, you know, just stood there and was the one who flipped and turned him in. So, you know, right at the outset, we get a three body problem where there's equal, you know, where the with these three people and the events are tugging against one another. Not even getting into the fact that this is about, you know, what we learned at the end of the episode as far as what was the mission here. But, you know, set those things up. And then, of course, we do fast forward to our, you know, so we get the one body and we get the second body with the folks and, you know, in London and.
Oh, so you're going to try to explain to me what the title means.
Well, I mean, I mean,
is that what we're doing here?
No. I mean, it dawned on me whenever I was watching, you know, this is such a vague title. It just kind of dawned on me like what, you know,
who are the three bodies?
Well, at least in the first episode, at least to me, it seems to be
change.
Huh?
No, continue. I'm just going to let you finish your thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. But like I said, I just really set things up really, really well. So what are your thoughts on it? I don't want to ramble.
I want to know I want to understand who you're like, you said something dawned on you. So, okay. So Wenji is the first body. Who's the second body?
Well, her family is, and you know, and Vera. I mean, you know that. So that's one unit. The Oxford Five is the second one, and then Clarence is the third, at least as far as the people.
Sorry, I feel like I'm doing like math in my head. It ain't adding up to three, but
no, like, not three literal, like three. No, not literally three people, like three units.
And that's why it's body instead of bodies.
Well, I mean, the second episode really gets into like the three bodies, the celestial bodies.
I'm so confused as what counts as a body and what doesn't. This is an excellent way for us to be talking about this show, because this show, honestly, everyone, you just have to watch it. You have to sit down, you have to watch it. I was surprised by how engaged I was throughout the entire two episodes. I think I fast-forwarded through one scene because I didn't really care about watching two characters have sex. But overall, I was really pleased. So as Will was saying, we meet Wenji in the past at the very beginning, and then fast forward to the present day, where her daughter kills herself like right off the bat. And that's Vera's death, which leads us to the Oxford Five. I'm just, as I'm talking, I'm trying to figure out a way to both review and explain what's going on. But all I really want to say is that overall, with this episode and the next episode, every time I had a thought of a question or an inkling of, wait a second, this isn't adding up, this logically isn't making any sense, what is going on, I felt as though the writers could hear me, and instantly the next scene, my question was answered. And not in a way that I was expecting. So for example, I want to say it's in the first episode that we meet, Augie meets Angelique. I think that's what her name is. At least that's what IMDb tells me she is. And it's because Augie is seeing these visions, and then suddenly she ends up taking a smoke and can't light her cigarette. And Angelique is there. And I'm like, where the heck did you come from? So that's my thoughts. See, now I'm rambling. I don't know how to talk about this show. I really don't.
Well, I was trying. Yeah, it's okay. I was trying to set it up, but yeah, I mean, it's a lot going on. I mean, I think the easiest way to do it is like really talk about the three different units, because
I was surprised in this episode how we started in China in the 1960s, but then we go to present day, and I'm thinking, oh, we're gonna be here for a while. But over the course of that first episode, we go back to Wenji's story.
Yeah.
And we find her at a work camp, where she's working, and then she gets kind of screwed over again. But then the military realize that she can be of use to them, and they send her to the top of the hill, where she, at the end of the episode, we learn about what this Army research facility is really doing, and it's called the Red Coast Project, which she, after a demonstration that kills a lot of birds, of birds die. It was basically a sequence from the birds that occurred. She points out, like, oh, this isn't, you guys aren't building a weapon. You're actually building a way to communicate with aliens. which, like, overall, I was surprised by just how much the past mystery, it complements what's going on in present day so well. It's not a parallel. It's not taking you out. It doesn't, like, these stories, yes, you Wenji's in both present day and past, but you're learning information, and it also, they don't repeat themselves necessarily.
No.
Or to the point where you're just like, man, why we get it, we understand. You, both timelines are you're being informed as characters are being informed, because really Wenji has some explaining to do in present day. She got some explaining to do in present day. So, and we'll get to the second episode and where she leaves things. But so while all of that is playing out in past, in present day, we meet the Oxford Five, which you were saying was our body number two.
Yes.
So, what about, so Vera's death kicks off our introduction to the Oxford Five, to Saul, Augie, Jin, and a few others. So what did you take about these five, like, college nerd friend group people?
Yeah, so really Saul, Augie, and Jin really were the three that stood out for me. Will and Jack, Jack, I was annoyed by Jack, to be honest. I don't know, was it something about, I know that was probably the intent of him to be an annoying character, but I think it just really did a good job of just sort of setting up the dynamic between the two, between the group, friend group, and when they're at Vera's funeral, we learn that Jen and Will, for example, did have a prior relationship. Augie and Saul, I think it seems like they're on again, off again. But they're trying to figure out what's going on, because Saul, the night that Vera commits suicide, I mean, she, they realize that the physics, something's going, the data is just like showing nonsense, and they're trying to figure out this mystery as far as what's going on, and why all the particle accelerators around the planet are having difficulty. So,
that's what Saul is trying to figure out.
Yeah. That's what Saul's trying to figure out. Augie, she starts to, she starts to see the countdown clock. And then she bumps into the mysterious person there on the steps, and when Clarence, sees later in the episode, we see where, when he talks to Augie about this, or was that the second episode?
That was the second episode.
Yeah, second episode.
But what you're getting at is, so there's a reason why those three out of the five of them stuck out, because they really focused on Saul's connection, or not connection, but the fact that Saul was working on the same project, the same science project that Vera did, and Vera ends up killing herself. Jin, she really isn't, nothing too odd is happening. She's kind of the normal friend for both like Saul and Augie. I guess that's a way to articulate. Her storyline actually comes in the second episode when Wenji gifts her something from Vera. Yeah. But and she starts to question, why did Vera kill herself? Which, you know what? Why aren't they all questioning this? Mm-hmm. Augie is suffering from visions, the countdown clock, which you mentioned. And so I also really appreciate how there are a lot of characters. Mm-hmm. And this is a big, complicated mystery. Yet, each character, like, it's not like the Scooby Gang.
Right.
It's really not. They all have their own lives. They all also are experiencing very different things and are folded into this overall story in very different ways. So it doesn't get boring and you don't feel as though you're watching the same story be told five times. Yeah. So I really like how only one of them had the countdown clock. Now, I don't know what that means. I mean, I don't know why. Also, obviously, Vera at one point had the countdown clock too go on. But why didn't Saul, you know, why didn't Jin? So it's interesting that I hope we come to understand more about what exactly was it about Augie's research that led to her being the one of the five that had that. And to go into Clarence, who I'm assuming is your third body.
Yep.
Because Will is on body count right now. We are introduced at the very beginning in present day. As an investigator who's looking into a researcher who pulled out his own eyes and used blood to write out a countdown. Basically, the countdown clock made him go crazy.
Yep.
Which we were starting to see Augie experience as well. So we understand. And he is really the one in the present day, besides Wenji, who has been looking into investigating why there are so many researchers who, out of nowhere, inexplicably are killing themselves. And so he's trying to really understand this bigger mystery. And so we get all of that in the first episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second episode is called Red Coast, and it's described as Augie's countdown jeopardizes her nanotech work. Jin becomes engrossed in an otherworldly VR game. Yi Wenji follows through on a radical idea. So Will, what was your take on the Jin VR game storyline that also ends up including Jack as well?
I at this point I'm just trying to figure out like how does it fit all into this larger story. Mm-hmm. And you know, one character we didn't get into much with the first episode, but it's a very pivotal character that Lee Wenji met in Mongolia was Mike Evans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and while she was in the labor camp, the journalist that she met gave her a copy of the book Silent Spring, which is a real book really was written in the 60s and very pivotal in like telling how pesticides like DDT and other things were poisoning the planet. So of course, whenever Evans was there in Mongolia and he was trying to like stop all the deforestation and stuff, you know, fast forward to present day, now he's like big industrialist and anti-vaxxer, anti, you know, anti-science, et cetera, you know, very wealthy industrialist. And so I'm wondering if his company is possibly behind this VR game, because, I mean, yes, we learned at the end of the first episode, they're looking, you know, the Chinese were looking for aliens with the transmissions and stuff, but it does, I don't know, I can't see how, at least at this juncture in the story, how the aliens would know to, like, drop a VR game like this. So so I'm wondering if he's behind it, or if it's some, you know, if it's something or something completely unrelated. I just don't really know. But the things that were going on in that universe really seemed to be, it wasn't clear to me, because, like, at first I thought the VR thing was attuned to, like, the individual user, like it was programmed, you know, for a person, especially to, like, the way things sort of unfolded between that was difference with Jack and Jen.
Right.
But then I was like, but that doesn't make sense, because Vera's mom gave her, you know, gave Jen Vera's old gaming set. So that, you know, so I was like, I threw that theory out the window. And then Jack later gets his own, like, you know, VR set. So
I think you're right in the sense of what you were initially thinking, because even though Vera's mom, when Jay gave Jen Vera's, the first person you encounter in the game didn't kill her. So there, that was taken as some sort of invitation, because Jack, when he puts it on, immediately gets killed.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I disagree with Will. I love Jack, partially because the actor who plays him, Samuel Tarly, Game of Thrones. So I'm just saying, my loyalty is Jack. He can't use that same one. And then when he gets his own, there are a few subtle changes in the game itself. Mm-hmm. And it does feel more like, okay, now he's invited to play. I think, like, I did not think about that, but I think you're spot on with Mike Evans possibly being behind the game in conjunction with Wenjie, which my biggest thing about present day Wenjie, and I hope, like, as the season progresses, we understand more about, is she's, in my opinion, she's in clear cahoots with the aliens. Okay. She's in cahoots, but her daughter dies.
Yeah.
So what's up with that? what happened there? Also, who's her daughter's father? Just saying.
Yeah. That was my thing too. I was like, I wonder if you know, because she did hook up, you know, she did have a pillow with the journalists there in the camp. So the time would probably be about right.
Yeah. So I don't think it was a journalist. I think it might be the engineer who like they have more of an antagonistic relationship with. Mm-hmm. And then my theory is also Mike Evans. I have that theory going on. So but and why it's very clear is because this episode, spoiler alert, ends with her sending a communication, because they finally figure out how they can use the sun to amplify the message. And she sends a communication because Mike interferes. I'm pretty sure it's Mike who's interfering with the call. That's because they pick up a signal and Wenjie translates it and says, "Do not answer. I'm a pacifist. If you answer, we will come and conquer your world." Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not delusional. That was from Mike, right? Like, it's just, it's weird to me how he can, like, I don't know. The fact that they say he's a pacifist and they just had that encounter and then the single is going out. So in response, she sends out another message that says, "Come, we cannot save ourselves and I will help you. conquer this world. So the lady chose her ally. She's like, fuck y'all.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes back to what I was, you know, trying to say at the beginning with the politics of it all, because she, you know, she sees this world as, you know, the politics, you know, she runs into the lady who like beats her father to death in the square, you know, in the labor camp. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you have all that, and you know, she's got this book, and you know what she's been through with her own ordeal, getting sentenced to the labor camp, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they showed her paws her finger, and I was just like, she's going to do it because she's got all the motivations in the world to like come fuck this place up.
but it's interesting because I don't feel like they are fucking it up. What's going on in present day is more of a warning. It's like, yeah, you shall not advance like to the point where you could come and take over our world. So it's almost like this alliance of, okay, you don't conquer us, but you also help us prevent from getting that knowledge and that advancement in technology to even become a potential threat. Mm-hmm. Because with Augie, that's what we really learned. She's given a simple choice. Either let the countdown clock get to zero, which you won't like what would happen.
Right.
Or stop your research. Mm-hmm. And we see it where she ends up stopping the research, clock disappears. And then Clarence just so happens to be like sitting outside the street, which was one thing where I was like, okay, how did he know? But then again, we also see him spying on practically everybody this episode. Yep. So yep. I guess, but I don't know. And he starts to fill her in on potentially what really is going on or his full investigation. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how it's not even, it doesn't feel like they want to conquer. It's more of, you shall not become a threat.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably because of some allies that they have, like a Mike Evans and like a E1J. So, but we shall learn more. I mean, this is crazy. We're just getting started. Yeah, and what I really love, I can't emphasize this enough about the show and having watched these first two episodes, there's a huge ass mystery, but mm-hmm. I feel like I've been given a ton of information.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not to where like, oh, well, it's so obvious. It's like, well, they're hinting, but nothing's for certain. Like in the VR game towards the end, one of the last VR sequences that are actually pretty cool because it allows them to give us really cheesy, low budget mm-hmm. graphics. But it makes sense. It feels so cheesy. But there's a scene towards the end where Jin ends. It's right before she finishes the first round and she kind of fails, but they allow her to proceed with trying to save the next civilization because she succeeds by proving that. What does she prove, Will?
Let's see. In the first one, she proves that, you know, because the first one they were using chance and religion to like, you know,
the superiority of science over mysticism.
Yeah.
And at one point, I think the emperor shouts and says, "Science on what? On which world?" And right there, I was like, yeah, the aliens are so behind this game. Because I go back to what Saul was saying in the first episode. And what was said a few times by, I think, all of Oxford 5. This isn't making sense based on our laws of physics.
Right.
But those laws of physics can be applied in a different world and make complete sense. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. So it's almost like, okay, if we take that piece of information, why is Winjay allowed to make friends with the aliens? Well, maybe they try to apply their laws of physics. And even though they're advanced, some of their stuff, their technology doesn't work here because we have different laws of physics.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Very, I mean, it's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, this, you're right. I mean, there was just so much to digest in these first two episodes, setting the table for what we'll get in the remaining six, but also just questions that it poses, and we didn't even get into we had the universe blinking there at the end of in episode one with Augie and Saul sitting there, I guess they were at Cambridge, I guess, whenever sure. She was in the courtyard.
They were at Anakin University.
Yeah. But then, of course, the next episode, to your point, there was no, the universe blinked and then, you're seeing its BBC, news story about, the thing happening, but then all the satellites didn't pick it up.
Right.
So did it really, I guess it happened, but there's no proof beyond people's observations that it did. So, I mean, it just really, I think even the Tatiana, I think her name, she shows up with Augie, but then she also later shows up, at Clarence whenever he's in the cemetery, just randomly bumps into, randomly, air quote, whenever he's, leaving the cupcake for his deceased wife. And so these encounters that are happening. And then she, I think in the first episode.
But why do you think Tatiana chose to have that encounter with Clarence? Because that's the first time he's ever seen her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I guess she clearly is whenever Augie, since he is surveilling everyone, Augie is sitting there, whenever they see the CCTV.
He doesn't see her in that footage.
Yeah, but he knows that she exists.
Well,
he knows something happened. He believes Augie. Right.
Yeah.
So I guess, I don't know if she's maybe one of the aliens or something else where she just, maybe she's the watcher or something or observer. I mean, I never read the book, so I don't, so I don't know how this is going to play out at all.
Which I just was curious if you had some sort of theory going on about why that interaction occurred, because it was very different. It was also very different interaction than hers with Augie, for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah.
But I thought, I was like, okay, so potentially that could be a sign that his investigation is actually starting to scratch the surface of what's really going on.
Yeah.
And he might start to pose a threat in a different way that is very different from the scientists who are suffering from the countdown clock. It's a lot. It's a dense show, but I'm going to say it again. Honestly, I don't feel like we're given too much information at the same time. It's just a very well-written show where you feel like there's a lot, but it doesn't feel like, oh, wow, I have to sit with this and really, really figure out and I have to rewatch it. I'm like, no, you get just enough information to feel as though you're following, but you're not given too much information to feel like you're too far ahead of what's going on, because hey, I feel like we're about as in the know as Augie is at this point. Jen, Saul has no idea what's going on. Neither does Will, and arguably Jack.
Jack's just having fun, in his little VR. When he finally got his VR headset, he was and is able to play it. He's like, okay, Yeah, but it's funny whenever he was in there too, because you know, so when he saw Sir Thomas More, he was thinking he was gonna get slikes down again, and you know, he was beating him up. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Well, X, formerly known as Twitter. Sorry, I can't even talk anymore. But at Will M. Polk, WILLMPOLK.
And you can follow me there too at SJ Belmont, SJBELMONT. Please follow our crew on Twitter at Scene and Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram and Threads at Scene_N_Nerd. And visit our website, www.sceneandnerdpodcast.com. But most importantly, rate, follow, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.